certain people are for sure are trapped in like the rat trap, and they know that it's just they feel they've got to try and get the next thing, whatever it is. So trying to communicate to them why you're doing that. Often I would, as much as it was to do with like the desire to see Spain, to explore, to ride the bike in places I hadn't seen and meet new people, I had to try and like kind of break it down, because to me, not everyone seemed to understand that desire.
Hey folks, welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Mason Gravely. Today we're talking to Chris Atkin, who recently did a journey across southern Spain, a bike journey, kind of as a way to brush up and learn better Spanish, as a way to learn kind of the history of the region, a place that he heard a lot about but never been, and thought, you know, riding a bicycle was a great medium to do it. And I couldn't agree more. It's like the perfect balance between walking and driving. You know, you still get to feel everything. You still get to stop when you want to. That's one of the most beautiful things about being on a bike, is if you see a really cool roadside stand or attraction or just something that you're interested in learning a little bit more about, it is so much easier, in my opinion, just to stop for a second, explore something. You see so much more going slower. It's an amazing way to travel. It's probably my favorite way to travel. That, and if I can, I love to backpack too. So if I can't be out in the wilderness on a trail, on a bike tour, on some empty back road, is there's nothing like it. But anyway, Chris's journey through Spain is just filled with random stories, all kinds of stuff, all kinds of people you meet. And he's going to tell us how he did it on a budget, because that's really important to this show, is how do we make these types of experiences more frequent in our life? And one of the best ways to make it more frequent is keep it cheap. All my adventures now are just as cheap as they were 10 years ago. So that allows me to do them on a semi-regular basis, and it can definitely help you as well. So if you'd like to hear more about Chris and his story, the book is called It's Not About the Bike. There's a link in the show notes for it. And I hope you enjoy this this conversation. Let's get into it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be speaking to you.
Oh, absolutely. Where are you coming from today?
So I'm coming from Palo Alto in Silicon Valley in California.
Oh, gosh. Now, is that home for you?
So it has been since September. My wife has taken a sabbatical. We used to live in Cambridge in the UK, and she was offered a fellowship at Stanford University for a year. So we have come to sunny California, which has been wonderful.
I was going to say, how are you liking California? Because I used to live there. I absolutely love it. Lived and worked in Yosemite for a while, and in the Bay Area, did a lot there. But California is wonderful. How are you liking it?
I mean, there's a lot to love. Just every now and again, like we'll go to San Francisco and the traffic will drive me up the walls.
Right.
just the fact that you can go on a weekend trip to Yosemite. And I mean, obviously the way that, and this is a sweeping statement, but the way that Americans view driving distances is very different to how the British would consider driving distances. Like more than, I don't know, an hour is quite a long journey for us Brits. But Americans are obviously very happy to drive for many hours in order to get to an amazing place. So once you just tweak your mindset a bit, you suddenly realize there are an awful lot of places that we can go and explore effectively on our doorstep.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good reflection. I'll be honest, I don't consider it a long trip unless it's over 10 hours of driving. And when you start making a radius around you 10 hours, it's amazing what can fit into that, especially where you live.
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is the thing. We've had all of our friends back at home all saying, you know, wow, you've been so busy, you've done X, Y, and Z. And we're going, yeah, we've really been trying to tick them off. And it's been incredible. Yes, amazing.
And what's so beautiful about, I know we're kind of going on and on about California, I love it, but what's so amazing about it is the diversity in just a few hours. You have Death Valley, one of the most extreme locations in the hemisphere. And then you have, within a few hours, Yosemite, Sequoia, the oldest trees, the tallest trees, and the largest trees, all within a day's drive. Lake Tahoe, you have the ocean itself. You just have such a mixture. Joshua Tree, there, it's really, really vast. And to have it all there is pretty remarkable.
Yes. I mean, when we came out, I was very much envisaging doing lots of surfing and like getting and honing my skills doing that. And we've not been surfing once simply because there's been so many other things and places to explore. And I'm going, right, summer's now arrived. I've got no reason not to be surfing. I really want to be getting out there. So yeah, it's just ridiculous when you've just got so many competing factors. Normally, if someone offered me surfing, that's number one on the list. I'm doing that. And yet somehow it's just fallen slightly by the wayside.
That's wild. I love
how amazing California is. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Y'all are eat it up. It's a wonderful place. But but that is not the topic of today's episode. Believe it or not, I mean, I could talk about California forever. You know, you did a pretty interesting adventure cycling through Spain, and you've written a book about it. But honestly, I want to go back before we talk about that. Where did you grow up? And I assume it's the UK, just strictly based on your accent. But what did you grow up doing? Were you into these kind of things? Were you this adventurous, moving all over the place, living all over the world, or did you have to discover it on your own? I'm always interested to hear where someone started.
Yeah, so for me, I think it's all about, it was something I discovered. I went on a few like family holidays and things, but it was only when I took a gap year by myself before I went to university. And that was when I realized that, A, this was something I really, really did want to do. And I just love traveling, and I will therefore eke out as much of a living as I can the rest of the time in order to go traveling and just see so many incredible places around the world. And if that meant I needed to go by myself or rearrange certain things around the rest of my life, then that's what it was going to take. Because for me, traveling was such a hugely important drive for me.
And you said your gap year was what started that off?
Yes. I mean, I suppose actually, to be more accurate, maybe it was interrailing around Europe with friends when I was 16 and 17 years old, just around, the first time was a 3-week whistle stop tour through France, through Italy, down to Greece. And then subsequently realizing that actually we don't have to try and do a city in 2 days and then move on, because at the end of 3 weeks, you need another holiday. So then took a couple of trips to Montenegro in subsequent years, which is one of those places that a lot of people don't know a lot about, but I cannot sing its praises enough. It's just great.
That is so awesome that's, you know, just such a part of culture. And tell me this is, you know, we hear about the gap year a lot, and that's not something that's really taken hold here in the States as much. There are people doing it, but not nearly as much. How many people are encouraged to do that? Is that just almost the standard in the UK, or is it still a minority of folks doing that?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's pretty widespread, but it's certainly a minority, as in you're not, the assumption is you're not taking a gap year. And when people find out that you are taking a gap year, the question is always, what are you going to do with it? And so it's been interesting hearing like what people are doing in the year of COVID, effectively, when they've not wanted to go to university last year, because they knew their experience wasn't going to be the same. So then suddenly been a much larger number of people who have decided they're going to take a gap year, and it's kind of been enforced upon them, which for me, I had the benefit, obviously, of going, no, this is 100% something I'm choosing to do. And I remember going to visit my friends at university in their first few weeks at the university I'd got a place to go to, and thinking I could 100% see myself here. I'm going to have a great time, I hope, as I did in the end. But equally thinking, no, I do really want to go traveling first and see a bit of the world before I show up at university.
I think it's smart. I love it. I absolutely love it. And what were some of the steps that led up to your bike trip, your experience in southern Spain? I know you were working full time for a few years, but what was kind of the reason behind what you did?
So I basically, fundamentally, I worked for a few years at Sky News in London, and then BT Sport, which is like the equivalent of ESPN for American listeners. And then I've always wanted to go and visit Spain, specifically southern Spain, as is a part of the world a lot of British people go to, and I'd never been. I spent 5 months after leaving BT Sport. I spent 5 months working in Panama's largest language school. So I was obviously honing my Spanish there a lot. And I really, at the end of that, I knew that my Spanish language skills were realistically the best they were ever likely to be. So I thought, right, this is something I really want to do, is to go to Spain. And the way I'm going to be able to see Spain and see parts of Spain that the tourist boards don't necessarily show you, because so much of it is to do with the beach, is to grab a bike and and basically keep costs down that way, and just explore that part of the region.
So why that area? It was just your interest in Spanish and part of what you were doing as work.
It was to do with my love of Spanish and the desire to try and practice the language, and also just I sensed there was so many places along that coastline which are famous, certainly to British ears, in lots of ways. And I'd never been to any of them. Like, people had always told me how amazing Valencia was, how incredible Granada was. And as somewhere that's not that far away from the UK, you're thinking, I really should try and go to these places and form an opinion of them for myself.
And why bicycle? Why not walk, or why not drive?
So to me, there are so many routes and things you just can't take by a car that you can obviously with a bike, and you're much more exposed to your surroundings, and you can see things just by necessity, have to travel much slower. So I get to see so much more. Walking was probably just a bit too slow for me. And I'd cycled a lot when I was young, and then I'd got back into cycling just as a commuter across London, so like 12 miles every day in the summer. And it made me fall back in love with riding my bike. And I just thought, this is the way I want to explore, to really like get underneath the surface of a country. To me, it seemed the best way to go.
So tell us about, the route you chose, where along southern Spain you went, and then also a little bit about your budget. I knew you did this cheaply, and that's something we always love to talk about here, because we try to make adventure just more accessible to people. And one of the biggest things to make it accessible is keeping costs low.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. To me, there are so many examples of people doing some amazing things, and you just think, I really want to do that. Like, for me, Japan is somewhere I'm desperate to go to, but just the cost of the flight to get there, Japan is an expensive country to be in and explore anyway. And you're just thinking, that's going to take a fair bit of money to do justice to. So for me, I didn't have very much money at all at this point, because having spent 5 months in Panama, So I came to Spain. A lot of people had suggested bringing my bike from the UK, which was like a workhorse of a bike. It's a Boardman cyclocross, which is like 5 years old, to bring that with me, which would have been fine for the job. But I am terrible with DIY, and I was worried that my bike might either disintegrate when I put it back together, or something would happen to it. Like, I think when I was listening to one of your podcasts with Greg on his mountain biking around Pakistan, when his wheel was just completely ruined upon arrival. And I was desperate for that not to befall me. So therefore, I made the decision to buy a bike in Spain when I arrived, and basically set off on it. And so that bike was, cost less than $200. It had 7 gears, and it was just a case of, just trying to do it as cheaply as possible. A lot of banana sandwiches. I allowed myself to try and explore, enjoy the Spanish cuisine, so tapas and things at dinner. But tapas is can notoriously become quite expensive as to a hungry cyclist, because a few slathers of fish and a bit of bread is not really going to cut it at the end of a long day of, say, 100 miles cycling.
No kidding, man. That is wild. That I love it, though. That's how you make it possible. And so, going with the cheaper bike, did it hold up okay? Were there times you had to figure it out and stuff breaks and you got to think on the fly?
Yeah, there was quite a bit of that. I mean, the bike, there are some times when you're definitely thinking, this is great, but why have I done this on quite such a budget? They're like, if I just got slightly more expensive components, this wouldn't have happened. Basically, I mean, the bike on the website is, the manufacturer said, it was designed for like poodling around town, like very lightweight. It could fit panniers, but only with very lightweight bags, and certainly not used for use on the hardcore terrains I was taking it on, up and down the Sierra Nevada. So there are a few times, a couple of spokes broke. The derailleur at one point completely bent out of shape, and I still don't quite know how this happened. But I managed to, in the end, I could only cycle in the highest gear, which meant that trying to cycle up any hill at all of any size I just had to walk for a small stretch of the walk, a small stretch of the cycle, which wasn't ideal outside of Tarifa. So yeah, there were problems en route.
Oh my gosh. So tell us about setting off. What did it feel like to set off on this experience? Did you feel excited, empowered? This is going to be awesome. I'm going to learn so much. Or were you thinking, what have I done? And also, how long were you planning to be out for?
So the plan was around about 6 weeks. I knew I wasn't going to break any like records with my distances covered and things. And I didn't really want to try and do that, especially on a bike which weighed like 11 kilograms and then had another 11 kilograms worth of stuff with me. So therefore, I wasn't trying to race to Gibraltar. And I guess it was it was exciting just heading out there. And also, I didn't know how long the excitement, to be honest, would last. I hadn't done any training at all leaving Panama because although I'd cycled a lot in previous years, while I was in Panama, I'd spent, I think, 20 minutes on a rusty fixie at one point, just having fun. So I was completely unfit. And I was a bit worried about whether I would get, I don't know, 3 or 4 days in, or certainly until the first like kilometer ascent and go, what am I doing? Like, this isn't what I want to do at all. So it was exciting. It was great. I realized how much I loved riding my bike and just the things you can see and the way you can, it's so easy just to stop and pull over and explore things that pique your interest. But for sure, I was worried that A, my body might break down and go, why are you putting me through this? And B, that I would just be there thinking, this actually isn't that much fun. There's a reason people do this by bus or by car. But yeah, in the end, that never really happens. Your body adapts very quickly. And I loved the experience. And I subsequently did another cycle, actually, around the Outer Hebrides in northwestern Scotland with my then girlfriend. And that was incredible.
Oh, I bet that was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. So was there an experience, or can you tell us a story about early on in the Southern Spain trip where something happened that made you confirm that it was a good decision? Because it's usually something that really starts to change the trajectory of the trip, you know?
Yes. I guess a good example is, this wasn't necessarily that early on in the trip, but maybe relatively so. Just outside of Granada, I was cycling. There's a small town outside, a small city outside of Granada called Guadix, which I knew nothing about, and I was all set for it to be a pit stop that was going to stay a night and then cycle on to Granada the next day. And it turns out to be this beautiful place, and it has the Europe's largest community of cave homes anywhere, yeah, in Europe, which is incredible, where 6,000 people live. And there's now swimming pools inside them. They have all the mod cons you ever need. So I had a look around the area, thought it was quite interesting. And then I was just cycling along and I was thinking, you know, the heat of the day is beginning to arise. I need to get a move on because otherwise these hills are going to become particularly punishing in the heat. And I saw a cave home that was open and acted as a museum as I passed. And normally you just kind of see these things in the corner of your eye and then you just drive on. Because I was on my bike and I was going relatively slowly and I was able to take everything in, I could see that this the cave museum was open. A man beckoned me over, called me up and said, come on in. It cost €2. And it was amazing just to see how a cave home looks inside, how it's structured, how they don't have any doors, but to let all the air circulate more freely, how it's basically like a complete labyrinth inside. Like, you very quickly lose entirely your bearings of the outside world. And however big a cave home seems from the outside, it's much, much bigger inside. And so it was an interesting insight, which you often wouldn't get. And I could so easily have overlooked if I was going by faster transport.
Did you know those existed before you started?
No, not at all. I hadn't featured on my radar. Like, I wanted to, obviously I planned out the route a bit and looked at vague pit stops, but I didn't want to plan out the route to any real degree because I like the idea of just being surprised and constantly thinking what's around the corner. Because obviously there are in any long distance cycle parts, you're going, I've just got to grind out the miles here. This is just, come on, just keep going. But there are times when you're there thinking, you just know that just around the corner is something that is genuinely really interesting. Like, for another example, is the enchanted city of Bonuevo, which was just this incredible 30-meter high sandstone weathered fungi-like shapes just by a beach that didn't have anyone there, aren't particularly famous at all, but I had to ride them all to myself. And they're just these huge giant objects that have just been shaped by thousands and thousands of years. And so that was the kind of thing, again, you'd see that you would never have picked up on particularly, but you just got to explore because I was on a bike rather than any other mode of transport.
I think that's one of the most beautiful things about bike touring or about traveling in general. And, you know, setting up a basic structure of the trip and not over planning is, a lot of times the most incredible experiences come from just discovering what's out there and not knowing ahead of time things that aren't on the you know, if you look at the Traveler's Bureau or brochure to Spain, those cave dwellings probably wouldn't be on there. The first list, that is. And they're somewhere in someone's list, but when you're on a bike, you don't miss anything. What did people think about your trip? The people that knew you, did they think you were crazy? Did they think he's lost his mind? What were some of the conversations you were hearing?
Yeah, for sure. There was a lot of that. I mean, so my now wife is amazing and is great. And so therefore, when I told everyone that I was going to go and leave her behind while I worked in Panama for 5 months, while she finished a postgraduate course, everyone thought I was crazy. And then to them, the idea of then going to Spain within, like, I don't know, being back in the UK for 2 days and then going to Spain, everyone was there going, why are you doing this? Like, there are perfectly good ways to explore Spain and you can go on a nice holiday sometime. Why are you doing this? It makes no sense. But I knew that a lot of people wouldn't get that. There is a certain people are for sure are trapped in like the rat trap, and they know that it's just they feel they've got to try and get the next thing, whatever it is. So trying to communicate to them why you're doing that. Often I would, as much as it was to do with like the desire to see Spain, to explore, to ride the bike in places I hadn't seen and meet new people, I had to try and like kind of break it down, because to me, not everyone seemed to understand that desire and the fact that you get the air in your hair and stuff when you're cycling. I used the motivating factor of practicing my Spanish to get most people to come round to the idea, at least, of why I was traveling to Spain and traveling around.
Were you able to practice your Spanish enough to get better?
Yes, no, definitely. There was one bit in particular where, I mean, when you're cycling, you spend a lot of time, obviously, with your own thoughts. And as much as I can try and practice my own thoughts in Spanish, it's not quite the same as having regular conversations. But with some hosts, particularly, I was able to speak quite a bit of Spanish. And I remember being in one hostel where I was like trying to make the bed with the sheets they'd given me. And I was fighting with one of the corners of the bed sheets to squeeze it around. And I realized I was having a conversation in Spanish with an Argentinian who was also in the dorm. And the fact that I was having this conversation almost without thinking about it, and the fact that he knew what was going on, I was contributing well, and we were having like a proper dialogue, and I wasn't even concentrating fully, I realized that was a sign that, yes, I really was far more fluent than I'd ever been. And so that was great, because a lot of the time when you're learning a language, it does feel incredibly frustrating that you just cannot quite express yourself as eloquently as you would like.
You had plenty of time to think about how to be better and to practice in your head as you rode around between conversations, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. There's a lot of verb conjugations you're practicing going, right, come on, that can't happen again. How would I say it next time? And I'd like, in terms of Spanish as well, there's a lot of times you're trying to say, can I help you? The way the verbs work means that you end up saying, can you help me, when you see someone in need. And so I was always very careful to try and go, hang on a minute, someone's struggling. What I don't need to ask for is for them to help me now, when you're just trying to offer some help. So, yeah.
That is hilarious. Tell us another story. I know you wrote the book and there's so much, you know, you're probably not able to share, but what was another hidden gem that you found along the coast? Something you weren't expecting. I know the cave dwellings was probably, I mean, the best example of that. That is wild. I didn't expect you to say that. But was there anything else that just you discovered or a moment or a day that was just spectacular that you'll never forget? Let's take a quick message break and hear from the folks that help make this show possible. That is plenty of that for now. Let's get back into the episode.
For big cycling fans, I would say the Sierra de Grazalema was my personal cycling nirvana. I mean, it wasn't surprising when I found out subsequently that it was used for the Vuelta a España, which is one of the big European tours of cycling. But the area there is just incredible. I love cycling, but equally, when it comes to these like kilometer ascents, they're hard work. Like there was one day when I was cycling up to Ronda from the coast. So I cycled away from the shore and took up and went past mountain goats en route. And that was incredible. You don't see that on many cycles. But for me, yes, the Sierra de Grazalema is this area just southwest of Ronda. And it's just got these rolling hills that are gorgeous, covered by lots of oak trees. And then you kind of descend onto this wide open plain. That for me was just one of those places where there was almost no traffic. The roads were relatively sheltered by shade. There was, and you just could just throw around your bike and have a great time. So I'd recommend anyone going there if they get the opportunity. And again, the Sierras de Grazalema was somewhere I'd never heard of. So yeah, it's just that was an exciting point for me.
Was there a place on the trip that was a low point or a time that you maybe felt you couldn't continue, or you didn't know if you could, or something that was, you know, underwhelming even?
Yeah, well, I had a issue when I was basically hoping to get from, I was having had the highs of Sierra de Grazalema. I was then hoping to get all the way down to Tarifa, which is the southernmost point of mainland Europe, by the end of that day. So that, which is, I think, about like 150 kilometers or so. So that was the longest day I was trying to achieve. And I got about two-thirds of the way down, and I got my first puncture of the trip, which wasn't the end of the world, I thought. And I looked down to try and take off the tire and realized, because my bike was quite so budget, it didn't have a quick release lever. And so when I looked down, I saw just a bolt and a screw. I realized it was a bit of a problem because I didn't have a spanner. So at that point, you're then having to go around the local area, which is this tiny, tiny town where it was late on a Saturday afternoon, almost nowhere was open. And I'm having to go around trying to ask like the people in pubs saying, do you have a spanner? And a spanner in Spanish is una llave, which is effectively a key. Everyone's there looking at you thinking you're a bit strange. And then I just couldn't get the spanner to work. And eventually I managed to get the tire off and get the new inner tube on. But at that point, I knew I couldn't travel the rest of the journey. But because nightfall was falling, and yeah, it was far too long to travel on a bike that was already damaged because of the derailleur and wasn't working. So I had to spend the night in this very small town, feeling a bit like the Virgin Mary, looking for a bed to stay in. Right. And ends up in a room above a bar, which was from like some kind of horror movie. It was just like there were blood on the sheets. It was holes all in the sink, and you're there thinking, oh, this is not quite the plan of this idyllic end to an idyllic day. But it was the next day. I got through it. I did think about getting the bus the next day, but because it was Sunday, obviously there are no buses in Spain. Spain shuts down almost completely on Sunday. So yeah, it was a case of going very slowly and limping towards the next place I could try and get my bike fixed.
You know, that's just a bad day. That can happen anywhere, and it's going to happen anywhere you go. Things are just not going to go your way at some point of any adventure. Was the journey across southern Spain, you know, because something we talk about a lot on the show is when you look at maps and you obsess, but when you prepare for a trip and you have a vision in your mind of what a place looks like versus how it actually is and how the people are, was it surprising to you?
To British people, when you look at that part of the world, everything is just beaches. It's British expatriates all having exposed themselves to too much sun, who are not necessarily of my demographic at all. So they're in their 50s and 60s. They've gone there to retire. There's some parts of it which are, there are some resorts which are huge in the 60s and 70s. and are at the time where like, all the Hollywood stars went to, but now kind of faded and have lost their luster. And so I was aware that I wanted to see those places, but I was hoping there would be more to southern Spain than that. And there was. I mean, there was so much more. Just the fact that I was able to find all these little gems of places and all the places that the magazines said, oh, you know, this is the best beach in Spain, this is the greatest place to see X or whatever, this is the greatest view. Like, there are so many places that you realize that further along the coast, you think, if all the tourists who were there and were fighting for space on the beach knew about, there's an entire like 4 or 5 kilometer stretch of sand with no one on and all the amenities you could really want, why are you not spreading out more? Why are you not seeing this incredible, gorgeous beach or this incredible panoramic vista? So that, and also the variety as well was something that really I noticed. Just that you've got the tiny little villages, beautiful orchards of olive trees and oranges and I mean this, and also that, and you've got the mountains as well. Just that there's some of the ones that are just incredibly bare and dry, and other ones which are like the Sierra Nevadas, the peaks in the Sierra Nevada, which are huge, relatively to me at least.
It does remind me that coastline does remind me of the California coast. I know we were just talking about that, but just I've never been, but just based on what I know about it and based on what I've seen, did you get that sense at all?
Which part are you talking about, like Southern Californian coast?
Like right around like Big Sur and some of that rocky shoreline that's really beautiful and mountainous.
Yes, I do. Yes, sorry, I see what you mean. I thought you meant in terms of the retired expats. Yes, no, for sure. No, there is.
Lots of British retired expats in Southern California. Yeah.
So, it is, very similar. There are certain parts of it which, the trees are fairly gnarled. And there are the beautiful spots and, the rocky, the granite and, and also the greenery, I mean, is similar. You can tell in the way the trees are green, but a lot of the other landscape is often not, simply because of the lack of water and like the drought we're experiencing in California now.
Yeah, always an issue in that region. I know this, a huge part of this journey was also learning about the region's history. How much of it did you know at the time, and how much did you learn?
I went into it with open eyes. I was never intending to write a book about the trip. So for me, it was just a case of seeing what I found and enjoying and practicing my Spanish. And then it was as I went along and met various interesting characters and discovered more about the places, and you think, actually, there's something in this. So for me, I think the thing that shocked me the most was the fact that in January 1966, the US accidentally dropped 4 hydrogen bombs on the Spanish coastline, each of which was 70 times more powerful than the bomb that exploded in Hiroshima.
Did they explode?
So one of them didn't. 2 of them exploded, but they had the fail safes worked. So therefore, there was significant plutonium contamination in the surrounding area. And the 4th bomb, no one knew where it landed. It was led to the biggest maritime search ever had happened at this point. And it took them several months, I think, to find exactly where the bomb was. And it lands out in the sea, where they and at this point, you've got the US are trying to desperately downplay the fact that they just caused this huge nuclear fallout on the part of Spain. They're also terrified that the Soviet Union are going to find find the missing bomb and take all the Cold War secrets. You've got General Franco, who's a Spanish leader, trying to get the secrets for himself. So one of the things the US did, they got their ambassador to Spain and Spain's tourism minister to go and swim in the sea, to basically just say, hey, look, there's nothing to see here. It's all fine. The water's not dangerous. Everyone come and have a nice holiday. When actually the sea was like full of plutonium, and both men exposed themselves to really bad radiation. But as it was, both men lived until they were like 89, I think, and 91 years old. But lots of the people who did clear up the contaminated area did die terribly premature deaths. And it was basically a whole part of the history that the US for a long time has basically tried to forget about and like sweep under the carpet. When considering how awful it is, it's surprising. And what's amazing about it is that it was one of 4 incidents that happened as part of Operation Chrome Dome, where the US were just constantly flying atomic bombs over Europe to make sure they could preempt any attack from the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And it was only when, a few years later, when some more atomic bombs exploded in Greenland, that they eventually realized that maybe the risk wasn't worth the potential benefit of having weapons constantly on call.
No way. The things you learn when you set out on an adventure. My goodness. So what eventually compelled you to write the book? And I'd love to hear more about the book, but you said you set out not wanting to. Was just this culmination of discoveries and of things you essentially weren't expecting to find?
Yes, effectively, yeah. Whether it was lots of small incidents, like, for example, meeting my Airbnb host and she just casually mentioning that she had strangled the last guest she had had to stay.
What?
And you're there thinking, what am I supposed to do with this information? Like, and she, it was clear that she wanted me to kind of condone her behavior. But you're there thinking, and you obviously don't want to, like, you're staying in her house. You don't want to chastise her or be rude. But it's, you're there in this awkward situation trying to think, that's fine. I would do the same. And she was like a very nice middle-aged woman. So just things like that. And then with the history as well and just the terrain I was traveling through and the experience of doing it on such a, arguably an appropriate bike. Yeah, it just made me think there's a lot of different aspects of this which people could enjoy reading about.
That sounds like an incredible story. I mean, along with that, what should people expect when reading the book? Because, you know, that story alone makes you want to check it out.
So the book's title is Just As Well, It's Not About the Bike. And it's obviously a pun on Lance Armstrong's first autobiography. But basically, it's because it's not really, sure, I cycled around Spain, but it's not about the bike. And it's just as well because of its limited nature. But it's basically just an insight into Spain it's a bit of a travel log, but also just picking out just lots of bits of history, which I think a lot of people will find interesting and humorous. I mean, going back to the incident with the nuclear bombs, like when the US found the bomb, they managed to drop it again and then lost it for a subsequent like 16 days. Like, it's amazing to think there's the things that kind of went wrong at that point. And there's all kinds of different stories from across history, which kind of arose whilst on the trip.
Unbelievable. What do you think the biggest lesson is that you learned on the trip? Maybe about yourself or about the world or about people. What is something that you take with you today that you learned from that experience?
I'd done quite a bit of traveling by myself before, so I knew that I could do it. I mean, it was only the traveling, if not the cycling. I think what was something that I like to try and remind myself is I stayed in hostels quite a bit. I stayed in Airbnbs quite a bit. And the experience I had from different people in Airbnbs was that some people treated you very much like just a source of income, which obviously I wasn't bringing in very much. And so therefore they would kind of be a bit brusque and short and kind of show you the Wi-Fi code and then not speak to you at all. Other people just want to talk to you all the time. And I think it's just a case of making the effort to try and chat a bit and to be warm to other people and not just and just engage. I think it's very easy, I think, for us all to get caught up. And I'm certainly very guilty of it, thinking I'm very busy. I've got lots of things on. Sure, I'll do what I need to do and then I'll carry on with the things I'm doing in life. And it was a good reminder of the benefits I felt when someone just thought, sure, I'm not going to give up my evening to talk to Chris. But it's nice just to have like a little bit of repartee about the city, what they liked about Spain, what they didn't like about the local area, any recommendations, all that kind of thing. So that was something I definitely would take away with when advising other people about where to travel and how to travel.
Wonderful lesson to keep in mind. To close, where can people find the book? And also, what do you have planned next?
So you can find the book on my website, chrisatkinonline.com, on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, all the major book retailers should be there. And then you can follow me on Twitter at chrisjat, which is also my Instagram. That's chrisjat. And then in terms of what's next, So while I've been in California, I've been borrowing my landlord's bike, and which is very kind of him to let me have it. But I am itching to get out properly on a proper bike again, which actually fits me. So quite what's next, I don't know. Obviously here we're quite close to Mexico, and so I'm thinking, you know, there is a huge part of, I mean, Mexico is such a huge country, it's a big distance to cover, but is there something there maybe? Otherwise, Central and Eastern Europe, there is just so much there that I would like to explore. I've been a bit before, but just, yeah, there's so many things to see, and I've got so many ideas. It's just a case of trying to fit them all in. Also as well, my wife is very jealous of my trip, and has basically said she's never going to let me go any of these places cycling by myself again. So trying to find a time where we can fit in to go together to these places is the tricky thing.
I don't blame her. I mean, that sounds like such an incredibly fun trip. And Spain, a place that I have not explored, that I would absolutely love to. And I've been looking at the map as you talk, and I'm just discovering things on this map, like, oh, I didn't realize there was a mountain range there or there or there. And it's got me itching, man. It there's so much to do. It's a little frustrating how much there is to do, especially when you live in a place that that has so much to offer. It's like, how do you even begin to choose? But the important thing is just to do something.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, just that's the thing. Like, there's so much in the US alone. You're thinking, how do you... It's difficult trying to stop myself just spending the entire time just driving from place to place. And you're thinking, like, I don't want to leave America having not gone to, like, Yellowstone and all these other amazing places. You're thinking, I'm going to struggle to fit them all in and just, yeah. And anyway, so, yeah, I'm going to have to accept that I'm not going to make it to everywhere, try as I might.
I tell you what, you know, as a lifelong American and as a lifelong pursuit to see this country, I've seen tons of it, but, you know, there's still so many frontiers I wanted to see more of or haven't yet seen, excluding Alaska, places like that, and even Hawaii. It's like, you just got to take what you can get, you know, and not overlooking where it is you are right now, because that is somewhere, I always tell people, you know, where you are is somebody's exotic location. Exactly where you are is where people have had life-changing moments in travel in your town. You just don't know it, because you're from there. Anyway, I know we could talk about that forever, but hey, thank you so much for joining. Is there anything else you'd like to share with listeners before we go? Any other stories or anything?
No, I think, you know, that's, hopefully I've given them a bit of a flavor. There are plenty more in there, but I suspect they would probably take up far longer than we have to share. So yeah, I will leave it there for now. But yeah, thanks for listening.
All right. Yep. All right. Talk soon.
Okay. Thanks again.
First of all, thank you so much for listening. It means the world to us that you choose to listen to this show. If you'd like to help us further, you can leave a review on iTunes, share us with your friends, your family. It goes a long way to grow in the show. You can also support us financially through patreon.com/adventuresportspodcast. Link is in the show notes. And also, if you have an idea of who could be a good guest for the show, we're always looking for people to tell their story about the outdoors or adventure. So if you know someone, please reach out. Email us at info@adventuresportspodcast.com. And until then, get out there and have some fun.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.